You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Hello and welcome. Today's episode is with John McKindo, who's the former Global Chief Marketing Officer of IRI, now Circana. You might know IRI as being the global tech leader in analytics and market data solutions, covering CPG and retail and media sectors, always competed very closely with Nielsen. John was responsible for IRI's corporate solutions branding, their global communications and marketing efforts. He was part of the executive that transformed this $600 million research company into a $6 billion SaaS analytics and data industry leader. John has enormous passion and expertise for creating disruptive marketing ideas that expand awareness and market share, drive revenue, and increase shareholder value. He's worked under private equity ownership. He's been in the agency world. In today's episode, we talked a lot about John's love for brand building, for building businesses, how he started off in the agency world, and a very interesting story of what it was like working under private equity. John shares a lot of great wisdom and knowledge about building alignment within the C-suite and not being too idealistic about brand. So here's going to be the interview with John. I hope you enjoy today's episode. John, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Gabe. I'm delighted to be here. I'm really excited about this topic.
John, you've been in a lot of different roles and you've been chief marketing officer, but as it relates to brand with a big B, as you think about your career, what was the first time that where you got your brand strategy chops, whether that was working in positioning, architecture, creative design?
Yeah, so it's funny. As I was preparing, as I said, I was really excited for this because branding, if you think about branding from the entire marketing perspective, this is really like the epicenter of where art and science really come together. And so I got really excited thinking about kind of my journey as it relates to branding. I started getting my feet wet in terms of branding on the agency side. I was working for an integrated marketing shop in Chicago, a division of a much larger agency. And so we were serving a variety of clients. And that's really where I started getting into branding work initially, a lot of positioning and messaging frameworks, helping kind of dilute and distill and kind of re-architect a lot of the messaging frameworks. And then that slowly started moving into a lot of design work and a lot of identity work. But I really think as I reflect back, I really caught the branding bug when I moved over to the corporate side and started becoming a member of a team that was responsible for brand overall on the corporate side.
But wait, John, you said you were doing brand work at an integrated marketing agency. That's not allowed. Only the branding agencies are allowed to do
it. I know. I wondered if you might take issue with that.
Shouldn't they have handed it over? Were they allowed to do it? Were they licensed to do brand work?
Well, that was the beauty of integrated marketing communications at the time. We do annual reports, investor relations, billboard advertising back in the day, and then we dabble in brand. So certainly not as good as what you probably are doing today.
Well, that's why branding agencies are getting their own back now and saying that they do campaign work and all these other bits as well. I think the lines have always blurred. They blur even more now. But I think that any agency says that they can do branding. It's just the depth of expertise. And is it something they're doing every single day? I did want to ask a serious question, though, which is, your experience having worked at an integrated marketing agency doing brand work and then having worked with pure play brand agencies, like what was the, do you notice a difference or not really?
I really do. And I've worked obviously on the agency side, just doing broader integrated marketing creative work, but having hired specific agency talent with domain expertise in branding, there's really no comparison. And I think we'll probably get into that in a little bit, but really kind of understanding, having solid understanding of what you know and what you don't know about brand is really, really critical. And I think that hiring a really seasoned brand agency for a multitude of reasons really can bring a lot of value to your overall process.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing how things have changed, because now you see a lot of people who are even on the brand agency side who have moved client side. I think branding used to be one of those topics where really there was almost a principal agent challenge, where the branding agency had all the expertise and there wasn't really much of a conversation, debate with the clients. Like, you as the agency always knew better. Now it's a lot more collaborative and there's a lot more expertise inside client organizations as it relates to brand than there used to be.
Yeah, without question. Totally agree.
So branding can be very messy when you're in it client side. Like, yeah, I mean, what was the difference for you when you went client side, you started working with brand? Where were you? What was that experience like? What was going on?
I had the good fortune of working within an organization that fundamentally understood brand. Their clients were some of the biggest brands in the world. Our clients were some of the biggest brands in the world. So
This is IRI, right?
This is correct, yeah. Which is where I spent a great portion of my career at and was the chief marketing officer for the past 10 plus years. And so we understood brand. Our clients were massive brands. But that didn't necessarily translate to the levels of investment and kind of the overall commitment that you would think that one might get from serving such powerhouse brands as PepsiCo and Anheuser-Busch's of the world. So there was a lot of educating, informing, inspiring, and really evangelism that was really required to keep the branding effort well-funded and top of mind in terms of our overall strategic agenda.
Even did the concept of brand mean for an organization like IRI, where it was very B2B oriented, it was very sales oriented, and probably very account-based marketing oriented?
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of work in terms of really kind of helping people understand the importance of brand. As a professional services firm, brand played an immense role and really underpinned virtually every aspect of the marketing machine. Professional services is really about building trust and preference. And so building a framework and an environment where the brand can help you become the partner of choice, and brand perception plays such a critical role each and every day, it's a strategic imperative. And so we continually put that notion at the forefront. And we did a lot of research to really understand where we were as the business continued to evolve. Did we think that we had the brand perception that was ultimately going to get us where we needed to go strategically? And then if not, what modifications, messaging, look, feel, et cetera, do we need to make, and how are we going to evolve this brand to come into our own in various portions of the business?
Is it fair to say that you were playing more of a challenger role because you were coming up against a behemoth like Nielsen?
We were. When I first joined the company and really we started looking at brand, we were in the number two position. And so there are advantages, pluses and minuses to being in that challenger spot, playing number two. A very nimble organization with a lot of agility and a lot of resilience, which I think ultimately helped us grow the business the way we did and really surprise a lot of folks and become the number one player over the past 8 years.
How did you do that?
A variety of things. We really focused on impact. And I think this relates to brand. What is the impact? What is the value that we're providing to customers? And how do we quantify that impact and make that central to everything that we do from a marketing perspective? We had a very smart CEO that came from a consulting background and understood the power of storytelling and imagine a world if you could do X, Y, and Z. We embraced a lot of that from a branding perspective to paint a picture, to paint a vision, to tell a story, and then build brand moments that helped illuminate that.
You also went through one of those sort of big moments that every so often you get a few opportunities in your career to go through, which is in the context of a merger or acquisition. Maybe tell us a bit about that story.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of refreshing the brand twice and totally redoing it twice during my tenure at the company. And each and every time we learned a lot. We had a unique situation in that we had this rich 30-year history. At the time, it was 30 years of this brand equity. Now, did we believe that some of that brand equity needed to evolve? Did we need to be known for different things and different elements? Without question. But we had this rich heritage, but we got into a situation where one of our ownership groups had been building out a master brand strategy for their portfolio of companies. And slowly over time, we're bringing people into their portfolio master branding. And so at the end of the day, we had to abandon that equity and rebrand as a different company name. We then were Symphony IRI, part of the Symphony Technology Group family of companies. And we didn't have a tremendous amount of time or really investment to build out new equity and sustain that over time. So that was a very interesting endeavor. And fast forwarding a handful of years, we ultimately decided to rebrand and return to our roots and our heritage and revert back to being IRI.
So, John, I think that Symphony IRI story, anyone who's sort of remotely geekish about brand strategy, I think is such an interesting story, because I don't think I've ever heard a story like this where a private equity owner, essentially what you were saying, decided to put their brand at the top of the pile. I guess the closest you have that I can think of might be when you have a company and underneath it might say a Berkshire Hathaway right. company. But this was taking it to another level where it wasn't like a deep level, like endorsement. It was as the lead brand, as Symphony leading it at the same level.
Yeah.
Like, what was the mentality that was even going on, but the private, as to why they wanted to do that? What was the rationale even for thinking like that?
Well, as you can appreciate and likely imagine, there were lots of differing opinions. I really tried to stick to a kind of a data-driven approach. We had had this rich benchmark information, understanding equity and value that we had within the marketplace currently, and paint a variety of different scenarios about what would happen if we made these series of moves. But at the end of the day, the decision came to be that we were going to embrace being part of this family of brands through the private equity ownership group. And so we went forward and we rebranded. But the big learning and the big takeaway is branding obviously is a long-term value proposition. And you've got to have heads in the room that are thinking about not only 1 year, 2 years down the road, but 5 and 10. And clearly we knew that we were not going to be owned by the same private equity group forever. But it certainly made for a lot of exciting times. Again, did a lot of test and learn throughout that brief rebrand. And we were able to come back. I was still fortunate enough to be in the role in the chair and get to do it all over again, embrace our roots, and come up with a lot of new and creative ways to activate and truly build out a brand platform that was going to take us into the future.
I understand everyone having different opinions, but was the rationale of whoever thought that it was the right thing to do, that they believed that Symphony brought specific equities and that they were going to invest in that, and that would itself have value? Just like whatever the reason was, I'm really interested to hear what the rationale was for doing that, what the strategy was.
I think there were several rationales. I think that, as you can likely appreciate, there was an effort to build out visibility and equity and awareness for this very successful private equity firm. And so I think that was probably the leading rationale behind it. It was at a time in the market where many of these private equity organizations were trying to build out additional capability and discrete capabilities around unique brand names. We've seen this happen in a lot of professional services. You look at, for instance, executive search, and they all create these boutique groups of companies, rename them, call them an XYZ company. And so I think that was the primary notion of it.
And then when they sold the company, you got to refresh it again, because then they had to remove Symphony.
Exactly. So we had the opportunity to really, really delve in and start from the ground zero. I was fortunate enough to work with a CEO that understood the power of building a brand, had come from very well-respected brands, and had the freedom to really do it from the ground up properly with the right amount of research and investment, and a process that enabled you to truly build out the foundational elements for world-class brand platform.
What was really critical, John, in terms of the process and the work that got you to a good outcome in that brand work? And if you're able to share what that sort of bit about that brand story.
Yeah, this will sound quite elementary, Gabe, but I think really being very clear about what brand will and will not do. I think you have to be crystal clear with ownership, with your C-suite stakeholders, and your employees about why we're embarking on this mission. What does brand truly mean for our business? And then give them the appropriate set of tools to help them be successful in being brand ambassadors. And it's everything from templates and brand guidance and premiums and logoed stuff, et cetera, down to what is your role as a brand champion? And that's constantly evolving. But really, I think bringing people into the process and giving them ownership of the brand, because no single group or person owns brand. The brand is constantly evolving. Brand is a collection of thoughts and perceptions at any given time.
Once the brand work, once the core of the brand work was done, how do you then successfully activate that brand, both internally and externally? Because sometimes you start with this very high level brand idea, and then especially within in the B2B context, translating that down into positioning and messaging and all the different industries and clients that you have and products and services.
We took a very holistic approach in terms of the effort, but I think the fundamental difference between our most successful branding effort or rebranding effort, if you will, and those that were less successful, we spent a tremendous amount of time developing an internal brand platform. We spent a lot of time with internal stakeholders doing a variety of focus groups and benchmarking research and a lot of dialoguing throughout the global organization to really understand a variety of different perspectives and enrolling a large number of employees into the effort really from the onset versus letting everyone this massive unveiling, which of course we did at the end, but we went and got a lot of support and sought a lot of perspective and input from the organization to really build out of a brand from the inside out. And we did an equal amount of work on the external to understand competitive landscape and variety of different stakeholders' point of views, clients and analysts and press and board and shareholders, et cetera. But you can't have one without the other. You can't just focus on external and all the pretty external stuff, and you can't just focus on the internal. So I think we did a good job in balancing the two. And that led to a tremendous amount of excitement that really ultimately put people in a different position of feeling like they had ownership and a role and a duty to be brand stewards.
Any sort of tactics or things that you did or ideas that you did that were sort of under the hood that you can take us under the hood in process that you think tell a story or made it a little bit more unique?
Yeah, we tried to really make it a lot of fun, but we also really tried to give people tools. We did a variety of collateral pieces. We did a whole host of videos, days in the life type scenarios to help people understand the different ways in which brand was occurring and the ways in which they could help shape that brand. We did internal naming contests and a whole host of kind of off the wall, fun, kind of wacky things to really get people engaged and bought into this transformation. Because it wasn't just about look and feel. This was about value proposition, the way we articulated our value to our clients and to the marketplace. There was a whole effort underway to really kind of outline and essentially help people understand what it was like to be an IRI employee from a recruiting perspective, how we work with one another, how we respect and interact with one another, how we collaborate. And so we felt that all of those things, you know, look, feel, act like IRI at the time. And so we really felt that that was critical to do that kind of work. And so we did a lot of that fun stuff, which really ultimately ended up getting people enrolled and getting behind it.
So as a marketing data and measurement company, how did you apply measurement to yourselves? How were you sort of going to be planning out to know if the brand refresh was working or not? What sort of metrics did you use or measure?
It's funny, Gabe, you likely have clients that want to just skip the research step. I was amazed being in the research and insights business and being such a quantitatively driven type of organization and space, there were a lot of people that didn't feel like we needed to have ongoing research around this. You could do it before and then after. I really pushed the agenda of constantly monitoring where we were in terms of brand health, both internally and externally. And so we did a variety of things to really help understand initial benchmarking surveys, both internally and externally, to understand perceptions and attitudes about it. And then over time, we would do these pulse checks to really understand, were we in fact moving the needle? Were we accelerating? And were we moving in the right direction? And how was that perception changing over time?
Can you go deeper and even more specific into some of those metrics, John? Because I think this is such a challenge that so many people face, which is brand, because it's something that in many ways can be ethereal. And it can be a challenge sometimes if you're just using metrics like how well are we doing now on this specific attribute or just awareness to then somehow tie that to the financials.
I personally took the opportunity to get in and try and gather insight whenever and wherever we possibly could. So we did our traditional benchmarking of brand perception that you would go out and do externally. We did something very similar, but we also did a series of activities at various events, as well as an annual client satisfaction survey, our annual employee engagement surveys. And I made sure that we had questions and areas of each of those instruments that delved into, do you perceive us as an innovator? Do you perceive us as a trusted advisor? Do you perceive us as having high quality talent, high quality information, insights, data, the accuracy of what we do? And we use those as a pulse, a data point, and a series of data points in time to paint this broader brand health picture over time. Clearly, you're aware of the type of ownership that we had, which is private equity. We had quite a job in helping them understand that being owned by private equity organizations, you certainly have the role and the responsibility to help them understand what is going to create value and not only growth for the company, but value for their shareholders. And the math is there. I mean, companies that invest in brand and do so continually are ultimately worth more at the end of the day. That was a piece of the narrative as we thought about how we were going to fund this and what was the return on our investment. We continually kept that narrative at the forefront. And it was critical to helping secure the support financially as well as strategically to keep investment in brand at the forefront.
What data sources would you use in order to, because you were saying that companies that invest more in brand deliver better financial outcomes. Where do you go to get that data source?
I did a lot of, and this is the help of brand experts, firms like yours at Monagle that live and breathe this every day. I relied on my agency partners a lot to help frame what was happening in brand today and peer into what other companies in our space were doing. A lot of competitive assessment and evaluation of what our competitive set was doing from a brand perspective. And then following a lot of their moves, taking stock in what those moves was brand a central part of some of these marketing moves, and then keeping a long list to be able to share that information back and say, hey, this is what our competitive set is doing, and here's why we need to be making similar moves or similar investments.
So, John, the whole sort of purpose of this podcast is to also get to the human stories behind the brand creation. So I'd just love to hear from you, what are some of the real sort of personal lessons that you learned in the journey that you went through in IRI and working with brand, and some of the mistakes that you've made, some of the screw-ups?
Yeah, it's been so much fun, and I learned something through each effort. It's been fun as a marketer to see, and certainly a marketer of data and insights, data come back into its own and really be the driver again. We are all data-driven marketers today in 2023. And so you have to really rely on the data. And it's a blend of art and science. From a brand perspective, and I kind of look back, I think I said this previously, but it really does take a village. Everyone has a role to play, from the people that answer the phones to the people that are out in the marketplace presenting, interacting with clients, to your senior executives. So one of my big lessons was take advantage of that. Inform, educate, inspire, and give them tools to go out and be amazing brand activists and evangelists. If you don't, I think you fall short. One of the biggest, I think, pitfalls that a lot of folks make is they keep the branding effort and the list of internal constituents smaller because everyone has opinion about brand. Gabe, you know this better than anyone. Everyone thinks, oh, branding is easy. It's just gut feel and do you like it or not? And we know that there's so much more to it. But I think you shortchange yourself when you don't invest in the internal side as well. You've got to get people educated and you got to get them excited about where you're going through really top-notch creative and paint a vision and help them understand why this is such a critical part of our business strategy.
Through the rebrands that you worked on, was there anything that you learned where something that you focus on that you thought was really important but later realized wasn't, or something that you see team members do or other people do, you say, no, that's not as important as you think it is?
Two things. One, a 125-page brand book. Your brand book, I think in today's day and age, can be like 30 pages. And I think probably the second kind of macro theme.
And sorry, why is that? Go on, we'll get deeper on that. What made you realize that, well, why do we need the 120 pages? Because no one reads it.
Well, right. Exactly. I think you need to create a framework where you give people enough license to express the brand and make things creative and relevant and individualized. It needs to be configurable, not necessarily customizable. This is a challenge of managing a global brand. We were a global organization, and so different things play differently, and that's why you've got to have a broad set of individuals providing input as you're building out a brand platform and the assets and the visuals and the creative. But at the end of the day, you have to have a set of standards and have to have a set of rules. And so giving them the tools to configure things and make them relevant for their markets, but not go so far off the beaten path that it doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like. It doesn't look, feel, and act like something that's on brand. I never liked the term brand police, and that's why we used an ambassador term, because no one wants to be policed. But it is essential to adhere to standards, and there are people that like to break the norm and not to use an approved PowerPoint template, and that ultimately degrades your brand.
If you're starting with a tighter set of standards that's only 30 pages, and obviously clearly you're giving a lot more room for freedom. So does that mean that then to go with that, you need a lot more training and reinforcement because there's more for interpretation? And then do you also need to have more of a feedback so that you get to see what people are doing and actually then celebrating and almost then reverse engineering some of those new creative ideas into guidelines, because then you start to show what good looks like?
It was a constant learning process. One of the things that we really got very good at was test and learn. I mean, obviously, you know, you can't be throwing out a new PowerPoint template to 6,000 associates every 3 months after you tweak things. But we really tried to have a continuous feedback loop. We sought a lot of input post-launch, and then made modifications, installments, and changes and enhancements and over time, and then updated people regarding those changes. Brand is not static. And the big learning from the massive brand book was, A, people don't read it, certainly don't print it anymore, but give them the 80% of what is going to make them successful to stay on brand and do the work and carry the load with 30% of this space, because no one has the time to delve in. And not everyone is a brand purist. Not everyone wants to dig in at that level of detail.
Is there a flip side of that learning, which is to say, is there an area where you weren't really thinking about that people don't think enough about that actually you should be investing more time that is key to success, but there isn't enough talked about?
Yeah, I think that many organizations underestimate the timing and the amount of energy within an organization is required to go through a branding exercise. I think many have the perception that it's just about letterhead and logos and banners at the top of screens. And it's really about cultural mindset shift. And I think that that varies depending on the scope and the depth of certainly the branding effort and how much positioning and messaging and business strategy is tied to that. But I think probably one of the greatest pitfalls a lot of marketers and branding executives make is really kind of underestimating the timing that it will take, not only to come up with the brand platform and all of the creative surrounding it, but also rolling it out and then having people really truly indoctrinate it and build it into the DNA of the business. That takes months and years. I don't know if you share that same perspective, but you often, I think it's typical for many executives and C-suite executives to think it's kind of a one and done effort and boom, we rebranded. So now we're on our way. And we all know that it's something that takes care and feeding and constant fine tuning and expansion and amplification each and every day that we're operating our businesses.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, if there's one thing that I think has changed most over the last decade has been that hard work actually starts the day that you roll the brand out. And it requires a not just a mindset shift, but thinking about the funding of these sorts of projects and the resourcing, because oftentimes the rebrand is done out of a single capital expenditure budget.
Right.
And then it's like, well, after the brand work's done, it's like, well, no, I need continuing operating budget in order to continue to sustain and drive it through the organization, connect it into culture and experience. And people need to hear things a lot of times before they get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the ultimate proof point to tell them what you said, tell them again and again. It's critical. And I think we've all bared witness to companies that have gone and done a big splashy rebrand or relaunch, and then all of a sudden they kind of fall off and you're like, where'd they go? Well, they spent everything in the first 3 months of launching it and big newspaper ads and all sorts of things, but they're not continuing to sustain that investment. And that's really essential. Over my career, I've had very tough conversations about, are we willing to make these investments over time to build new equity? If we're talking about a total brand overhaul, a rename, re-messaging, et cetera, because if not, we're likely better sticking with where we're at and working to try and build on the existing equity. Equity takes time and money and energy and mind share to create.
Yeah, I think that's a really important lesson that from a real executive lesson that you did. It's not to say we need to go here. It's say, if we're going to do it, then this is what it's going to take. Otherwise, it's okay. We can stay here. We can do either or. It's not an idealistic mentality to say, no, we must do this. No, we can still play with what we've got.
Yeah, without question. You have to really, as I said earlier, be very clear about what the goals and objectives are. And it's tough when you're sitting in a boardroom and you've got pressure from ownership and perhaps even fellow C-suite members. You've got to stay true to what you know is correct, which is clear alignment on the objectives and the goals of what this branding effort is to do for the company.
So, John, it's sort of like I liked in with a cool bit of a wisdom round, which is getting a bit more personal in your background experiences. What would you describe as being your superpower?
Oh, my superpower. I'm not so sure it's my superpower, but this is what a lot of colleagues kind of like to say. I think I'm pretty good at staying calm. Like, there's been a tragedy. Let's try and stay calm. We're going to get through this, and kind of being that steady guy in the boat that keeps us moving forward.
I have to ask you, can you tell us about the guitars behind you?
Yeah, I certainly can. I thought during the COVID pandemic that I would actually learn how to play these, all that free time we were supposed to have. But I have collected these at a variety of events that we've put on. A couple of them are signed by some pretty big name country artists. You got the Jersey Boys over here. And so someday I'll learn how to play them, but not just yet.
Well, they look great on the wall.
Thank you.
How do you get the most out of agency partners?
Oh, that's a great question. I have been so lucky to have really phenomenal agency partnerships. I think it ultimately, and this is going to sound so pedestrian, Gabe, but I think it's about trust, respect, and transparency. I started my career on the agency side saying, know what it's like, but you hire an agency for a specific set of reasons. And I think you have to empower them and trust them and their expertise, and then ultimately treat them the way you'd want to be treated, even though you're the client and quote unquote the boss.
Being at the CMO, one thing that we often hear from people who are in a brand role is, how do I make the case internally? Like, I can't just really struggling to make the case for brand internally. My executives don't get it. Having been in the C-suite and as a CMO, what advice do you have for those people? Is it, and it's okay to say, well, leave, go work somewhere else. But
no, because then you're walking away from an exciting challenge. And we all know what a thrill brand is, and rebranding and building out brand. I think you just got to be really honest about your reality and meet people where they're at, and then lean on your brand agency and your partners there to say, hey, this is where we're at. This is where we're trying to go. We need to, as equally as important as the ultimate brand work will be, we can't do that brand work unless we get people thinking differently about brand. And so what I did several different times, and it's proven to be a winner for me, was to go out and tap those relationships, get a pulse for where we are at across your key stakeholders and your ownership, and then build strategies based on where that mass or those individuals are. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all approach. Everyone's got very definitive opinions about it. You can have the guy or the woman next to you on the left thinking we need to become a household name, and the individual to your right, your colleague, your partner on the right, thinking that everything is just fine. And ultimately, you want to be somewhere in the middle. It's not a one-size-all-fits approach in terms of, I think, building in support for branding activity.
And last question, if you could go back and give some advice to 30-year-old self, what would that be? I know that's only a few years.
That's last year, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
I did this in a previous interview, so I can't make that joke every single time.
This is a good one. Take risks. I mean, I think some of my greatest achievements and accomplishments have been when we took risks. And I know that sounds trite, but notably in the marketing space, you have this ability to test and learn in small ways, medium-sized ways, and really large ways. We look at the rise of artificial intelligence and self-learning and machine learning. We have the capacity as humans and marketers and executives to do the very same thing. We just have to get in this constant muscle memory pattern of taking a risk, testing it out, evaluating, learning, and making it better.
That's awesome. John, the conversation has absolutely flown by. It's so helpful and interesting to hear brand perspective from someone who's not only been in a CMO position and also in an industry that's research-oriented where you're working with some of the best brands in the world. Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. And I'm really excited that you guys are tackling these topics, because one of the things that we constantly rely on as marketers is peer perspective. And so bravo to you for doing this kind of stuff. I really appreciate it, and thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Jim.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.